It was spring in Canada, which meant it could snow at any time. Despite some typical warm weather, a major snowstorm had hit, dropping a frigid 36 inches of snow through on the remote countryside. This made for dangerous passage when one was dependent on canoes to check traps that had caught beaver and other animals. During the seasonal transition, bears and other threats could be checking traps as well, which such impromptu meetings were not universally welcomed. Snow or not, the work had to be done. The main person in our story today, or this first part, loaded up his canoe and started out at daybreak. Ahead lay rapids that were swollen with snow and rain. 14 hours of hard upstream paddling. He finally arrived at his trapping cabin. It was dangerous weather, and they both knew it. So for the next few days, the pair traveled slowly over messy snow and ice, dragging overloaded canoes, portaging and vaulting over snowpacks, sometimes 10 feet high. Kind of sounds like when Mr. Turgeon and Dr. Pacelli went on their little tour there. Snow continued to fall off and on. It was exhausting and treacherous work. One mistake or severe injury and life could be over. So finally, on the last day, before a hard canoe trip home, the two men came on the most hazardous part of the journey. With canoes packed with furs, food, and equipment, they came up on the Pipestone River Rapids. They'd already gone through many rapids, some mild and some too frothy to cross. Those required a very long and slow and hard portage. The Pipestone River Rapid was something different. It was a big, deep, high rapid with about a 4-foot drop and a backlash of full 2 feet of angry white water. The portage was blocked by steep snow, but the two men struggled to pull their canoes up on the summit and got to work. "Don't forget to tie your canoe," our man warned, especially since that particular canoe carried all their equipment, most of the money they were going to be selling their furs for, and weather gear in case things got worse. So as they worked to get the canoes all put together and get the one canoe down this long portage, they started back up. Then something came into view. The second canoe was gone. As they slipped and ran to the bank, they saw a horrifying sight. The second canoe was floating out on the water, bobbing towards the rapids in more than 10 feet of swift water. Shocked, the man's friend prepared to dive after the canoe, but he was restrained. Our main man said, "Don't do it. It'll cost you your life." So as the canoe drifted out of reach toward the thundering rapids, both men knew a disaster was in the making. Half a year's income, food for the summer, and much more was riding in that canoe. Without it, they would be lucky to get back alive. So as the canoe turned sideways in this fast-rising water, the man's companion turned to him and cried, "What should we do?" Our hero said, "We will sit down and pray." He told me personally this story a few weeks ago, and he said, "I knew we were powerless. We may not even get back alive if we lost that canoe, but if we did, we would face a long, bad summer. So I got on my knees, and I prayed to the God of the universe. There was no time, but I prayed, and I said, 'God, you made this universe. We are powerless. You alone can save us.'" The story continues. He said, "I had seen miracles before, but this one remains vivid and clear. Before his eyes, instead of broadsiding, splintering into pieces, and spilling all the contents in the swirling white water, he said, the canoe turned nose first and went straight down the rapids. The pair ran back to the other canoe and chased it down, following the second canoe through pounding white water, dodging sharp rocks and waves. As they watched, the pilotless canoe inexplicably turned off the rapids and safely glided into a quiet cove. After recovering this miraculously intact canoe, the pair spent the rest of the day paddling home in humble silence. Our main person in this story is someone you may know, especially if you been to Minnesota in the summer. His name is Floyd Kilcheski. He's a legendary caretaker of the former SEP YLU camp in Orr, Minnesota. You see him here in the center between the three people from Minnesota, his wife and our president. He told me this long story of the Feast and the Feast of Tabernacles in Panama City, and then he gave me this book, and he said, don't forget it. It's in the book, if you want to read it. But he concluded with this. He said, I will never forget that situation as long as I live, because it was very, very dangerous. It was not the kind of thing you would want to do every day. So what does a canoe trip have to do with today's message? And what does it have to do with us today? As I heard him say this very passionate to me, I haven't seen him for decades. Both my wife and I were very privileged to hear him tell many stories. This has a lot of bear stories in it, too, if you like bear stories. But I came away very struck. I was struck by his earnest plea to a supernatural being that Floyd called the God of the universe. He said to me, he said, it was not the first time I had prayed to the God of the universe, and it wasn't the last time the God of the universe answered. So, my question today and what we'll examine is, who is this God of the universe? And that's an especially powerful question during this time of pandemic, as when we watch people suffer from COVID and even hear of some of them dying. I really appreciated this, the other message today, especially as it was from Mr. Cobb, it was talking about what we are facing. It's not easy, but God gives us resources to deal with this. We find the answer about the God of the universe in some unusual places. There's one book that talks about this God of the universe in great detail. It might be a little surprising to know it was written by the Apostle Paul. In fact, this particular book that Paul, or letter that Paul wrote, talks so much about the universe that it makes some biblical criticism scholars doubt whether Paul wrote it. One even called it the cosmological letter of Paul. I speak here of the book of Colossians. Colossians was written to a group of disciples living on the coast of northern, or not on the coast, but in the center of southern Turkey, what was once a major center of commerce. Town was about 12 miles west of Laodicea, a well-known book in a city in the Bible. But Paul had never been to either one of them, and he had a special message. He was asking, and he was trying to deal with some specific messages that people were undermining the power of God and his place in the universe, particularly the role of Jesus Christ. He said, read both letters, the one I wrote to Laodicea and the one I wrote to you. We've lost the Laodicean letter, but we do have this very unusual letter to the Colossians. In the epistles to the Colossians, Paul proclaimed Christ to be the supreme power over the entire universe, to be this literal God of the universe. And he uses unusual language. In one sense, the Colossians could be called the book of all, because all the times all is mentioned. Paul wrote to these people very early on that he continuously prayed for them, and he had an unusual prayer. He said, may you be filled, and I'll do this the way Ralph Helge does. You don't have to look this up, or you can just read the slides. And my apologies to anybody listening on a telephone hookup. It's a little bit hard to do that, so I'll try to amend that somewhat. But he said, may you be filled, he was praying, with the knowledge of God, of his will and all spiritual wisdom and understanding, that all word. So as to walk in a manner worthy of the Lord, fully pleasing to him, bearing fruit in every good work and increasing in the knowledge of God, being strengthened with all power according to his glorious might. So what are we talking about there? What was Paul talking about when he said all power and he said glorious might? Those are pretty unusual words and phrases. It doesn't leave anything out. All power. Then all of a sudden, Paul jumped in some vastly different language in describing Jesus Christ that he doesn't do typically anywhere else. We start in verse 15 of Colossians 1. I'm reading from the English Standard Version. He, meaning Jesus Christ, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. Now here it is. For by him, all things were created, all things, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. That's real important for the rest of our message. All things hold together. He does describe in very important detail the supernatural being whom Floyd Kelchesky described as the God of the universe, a God of all power. What does that mean? Well, let's look at both sides of this, and I'm going to fly through some things and some time today, as you'll see, but we'll make it. Here's what the late Carl Sagan said about the universe. Carl Sagan was a son of a Ukrainian Jew, lived in New York, grew up a very brilliant man. He was an agnostic. He was never an atheist. He said probability never has zero. And actually, ironically, talking about probability, the Register of Ambassador College, Dr. Bill Stanger, had a very interesting correspondence with Sagan over this very topic. And they exchanged a number of letters about the possibility of God, even before what I'm going to talk about. But here's what, you can see what he said. He said the universe is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be. That's kind of a reflection of what used to be known as the steady state universe. The universe is always there. It's always going to be there. It doesn't, it's infinite. And that we don't need a beginning. We don't need to deal with any of these issues. That was believed very strongly for many, many, many years, even centuries. And especially in the first part of this century. So this godless, drifting, purposeless view of the universe gets a little even darker when we consider what evolution biologists and a man who could only be described as an evangelical atheist, Dr. Richard Dawkins, says about the physical universe. He says it has no design, no purpose, no good, no evil, nothing, but blind, pitiless indifference. That's the universe he lives in. But the Bible doesn't say that, and as we'll see. A mindless, purposeless physical universe, that's a convenient label. Especially if one wants to avoid a God who has laws and a purpose and an expectation of some kind of behavioral responsibility. So, what about this God of the universe? Do you leave any signatures that you and I might be able to see today? Well, let's just talk about you for a moment. I love that saying, says, that's enough about me. What do you think about me? Seriously, let's talk about you. So you're sitting here right now and everything's kind of quiet and, you know, you're trying to avoid dozing off, right? And I'm trying to get done on time. So, but it doesn't seem like anything spectacular, right? Well, actually, you're spinning at 1,500 feet per second. Pretty close to 1,000 miles an hour as the Earth is turning on its axis. And you can see the proof of that in a couple hours when the sun sets. That's how fast you're going right now. That's only one aspect of your current travel velocity. While you're also sitting here, you're spinning. But you're orbiting the sun at a speed of 18.5 miles a second, roughly 67,000 miles an hour. Meanwhile, the entire solar system is not static. While you're sitting here listening to me, the planets and the sun are corkscrewing. There's a really nice, you can look at it, it's called the helio effect. You can see that on YouTube where you see the planets and the sun corkscrewing through space being drugged by a black hole. How fast is that? Try 136 miles per second or some 490,000 miles per hour. So that's what's happening to you right now, even though you may not feel it. So all that motion is carefully regulated by a black hole, which we're not going to go there. But also we know that the moon controls the axis. It pulls Mr. Turgeon was talking about he loves the fall. Well, 2.5 degrees tilting of the axis as the Earth orbits the sun produces that seasonal change. But slightly more, we have massive climate change. Massive. To the point where life may cease to exist on Earth. So the God of this universe who Floyd Kelchesky prayed to is incredibly active. Paul emphatically formed the Colossians, as I mentioned, that Jesus Christ holds everything together. And that's exactly what it meant. So, in the time we have remaining, let's take a closer look at exactly what this God of the universe has been up to. And what does it mean when Paul says, all power? An incredible amount of information has been analyzed and discovered in the last century, and it's really changed a lot of things. Those who are honest, there are a number of physicists and biochemists and people like that who have changed and who were once devout atheists or at least serious agnostics who are now believers in religion because of what they've seen. But it's interesting because these people come from a background that doesn't buy that. They live in an era where scientific materialism rules, which is, as you can read, the belief that physical reality is observable only through the scientific method is all that truly exists. That's it. But as we'll see, that's not the case. And I propose to you, and I propose to show this in the next few minutes, that if you look at the universe in an honest way, the God of the universe looks back. So before we go any further, there's an important point. Anytime you talk about the universe, you have to talk in terms of really huge and basically incomprehensible numbers. And I know one talks about incomprehensible numbers, entire rooms of people go instantly to sleep. So we'll talk about things a little differently. Let's start with what happened to the once widely accepted steady state of the universe. Thankfully, that's a pretty easy one. The Big Bang Theory, the singularity where all stars are pulled together. And as we see, the bright signatures of the God of the universe are all over the Big Bang. Many scientists didn't like the idea of the Big Bang originally because it requires a beginning. The steady state of the universe means that the universe is always here, it's always going to be here, and you don't have to worry about it because as long as we've got gravity, that's what Stephen Hawking says, as long as we have gravity, the universe can invent itself. But the evidence is contrary to that. So how did we get to this thing that we went from a steady state universe to it was demolished and now we have the beginnings and a belief in a beginning through the Big Bang? Well, I'll go through this pretty quickly. But it has to do with a thing called Olber's paradox. Olber's paradox refers to the mystery of the night sky. Have you ever wondered about this? Whenever you look at the night sky, right, we know today that we're looking at a time machine. The light we see when you walk out into the night sky is millions of years old. So you don't know what's going on right now. You don't know what God has done because it's old. But they didn't know that at the beginning. So Olber's paradox purported that if you fly over a forest, they didn't do much flying in the 1800s, but if you fly over a forest, you can't see the trees. All you can see is the forest. So the point being is that if the stars were always existent, this is what you would see. You would see bright light instead of individual stars. So that's when they finally start saying there has to be a beginning because the light from these stars hasn't reached us, and that's why we can still see individual stars. So the truth starts to dawn, no pun intended. And did I just kill my So through this, I would like to remind you of a verse in Romans 1 where it talks about God says, and it's ironic because a lot of these people who have converted are astronomers and people like Sagan are astrophysicists and deGrasse Tyson, and they should know better. They should see these signatures. But they try to get around it. So it's obvious, and this is what the physical pieces we're going to talk about here. The universe does have a beginning. So how did we finally figure all that out? Well, it was confirmed in a little place called Pasadena, California, actually in Mount Wilson on the mountains right behind where a huge telescope was. And there was a man named Dr. Edwin Hubble at Caltech, who the Hubble telescope is named after him. And he discovered two really important things through that little telescope. These were actually purported before him, but he was the one who confirmed them. He confirmed something called the redshift. The redshift is when you look at the electromagnetic scale and you get into infrared, which you can't see. And you see, when you look at galaxies, you can see that the stars are receding. That means they're not in one place. That means there's no steady state. That means they're moving. That means they're expanding. So he was able to confirm that they were expanding, and he was able to confirm that light had not reached us, which required a beginning. So the steady state of the universe piece, even though some people refer to it now, it got annihilated, especially when you combine it with the general theory of relativity. Because the bottom line of general theory of relativity, without putting everybody to sleep, is that at one time, if the universe is expanding, that means at one point the stars were all crammed together in one place. So if you got a pin, you look at the tip of your pin, the universe at one time was smaller than the tip of that pin. And that's observable through physical evidence. So we got a real major problem starting to show up for the people who believe in pure scientific materialism. It's starting to crack a little bit when we look at the actual signatures of all that we have. So let's frame that up and look at the Bible. Now, what we're going to talk about, there's some people who believe in what they call the young universe, which everything has to be crammed into 6,000 years, and we don't teach that. The Bible doesn't teach, it's not a textbook of science, so it doesn't say one way or the other. But it is pretty interesting when you frame up what we read in the Bible and what is the physical, material universe, that things kind of click together. So we have in Genesis, in the beginnings, God created the heaven and the earth. But when we get to the second verse there, we all know that it's very different. Suddenly, we've got all kinds of different situations. The first positive declarative sentence suddenly faces all kinds of issues. Was, as you know, anybody can confirm, this is very easy to confirm, can be easily translated as became. Some Bible translations, like the NIV, actually use or at least link it. But the big thing was the fact that it's tohu wabohu. That means emptiness or futility or without form and void, and it kind of contradicts. I've referred to him before, there's a very well-known Hebrew scholar, particularly in Hebrew poetry, Dr. Robert Alter. He just finished an entire translation of the Old Testament, and he points out how these words are very powerful, and they actually rhyme with each other, and that's a form used in Hebrew to emphasize. So something's wrecked. So let's not go there right now. Let's go back to the Big Bang, and let's go back to the beginning of the universe, some 13.7 or 13.8, give or take a few hundred thousand years of what we're going to be looking at. So here's the Big Bang, all right? And you see that over time, this is a very long period of time, 13.7 billion years, or 13.75 or 13.8, depending how you measure it. But the key point is that within a tiny fraction of a second, very, 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 very small, this all happened. This front end you see to the left, where everything all of a sudden, and there was no universe. A lot of people think, oh, well, there was this, God delivered this little package and it expanded. No, there wasn't even a universe. It was all created all at once. And it was unbelievably hot. It was over 2 billion degrees Fahrenheit. And all the matter of the universe was in this little tip of your ballpoint pen, much smaller. But then it starts expanding, and it undergoes what is called inflation. Now, this is your first, apart just from the Big Bang in itself and the creation of the universe, here's your first signature. Because this inflation is the whole process of the Big Bang stops, and it goes sideways. And what it does is that makes the universe as big as it is today. And that has been confirmed through a variety of different functions. And there is no explanation for it except for a fine-tuning by somebody who intelligently designed and made this happen. It's impossible. They will tell you, their explanation is, well, the laws of physics didn't exist then. That's the explanation. Well, God was there. So there are many signatures in all this. But the big one is that when this happened, and this is the coup de grace, and you can do this yourself. When the Big Bang happened, one of these fine tunes is this cosmic electromagnetic energy was created. And they didn't find it for years, many years. And then one day at Bell Labs, these guys heard this hum and they couldn't get it out of their transmitters. So they tried and tried and tried, and they found out it was everywhere. And that was the confirming energy that proved that the Big Bang took place and that there was this massive explosion and very complicated form of energy and matter creation. You can see the Big Bang left over on your television set whenever you unplug it. You see the static. About 2% of that is that cosmological microwave radiation left over from the Big Bang. You can see it yourself. So, rather than continue on here and have our eyes all glaze over, we'll continue on. So we get to this point now, we're going to show this calendar, and these numbers are so huge that we're using this form where the entire creation is crammed into one year, one calendar year, 12 months. And you can see the front end of this, that it isn't until September when life appears. If we're going from January to the end of the year, it isn't until September when life is created. And that's when we see this verse, magnificent verse in Job verse 38, beginning in verse 4, where God talks about the foundation of the earth and the morning stars singing together and the sons of God shouting for joy as the earth begins to form. That is the technical foundation of the earth. So that included all the archangels singing together, including one named Morningstar, or Shining One, who ends up doing something quite different in a few million years. But the plan of God kicks into high gear. Is this when Morningstar was given rulership of the earth? The Bible doesn't say. But there are some interesting things to think about. During this process, there are numerous fine tunes that are inexplicable. Somebody has to do something to make these things happen. And so they have very crude explanations that are inelegant. But at the end of the day, you end up with some suggestion of a signature of God and an intelligent designer. In fact, when you get to life, things really change. We've got some biologists here and some people who have taken organic chemistry, so I have to be careful. But there is one common, what they call hyper-exponential number of the probability of the existence of life. And there you can see it, 10 to the 10 power, that's a 10 billion, raised again to the 123rd power. I started to put all the zeros out on that, but it would take numerous slides. That's the point, that's the possibility of life moving and becoming aware here, or existing. So what does this mean? Well, if you change any of this, and there's a great book called Return of the Hypothesis of God that goes into this in great detail. Thank you, Dr. Rothenbacher, for the tip. But if you take this in very any of this stuff, very slightly, talking about the fine tunes, a couple of degrees change, no galaxies. A couple of other degrees, no carbon. You're made out of carbon. Carbon comes from the heart of every star. So you are literally star children. We all are, because we're mostly carbon. If you have a change in electromagnetic energy, then there's no heavy elements and life can't exist. So the point being is that this little piece out of this book is really nice, and there's a huge, like, 16-page explanation of it. But the bottom line is that all these have to exist for the universe to come into being. And that leads us to what's called the anthropic cosmological principle. And all I'm going to say about this is that it proves that the probability of life is, A, very remote, and the fact that it's on Earth, it takes the entire universe to make this happen. So we'll go back to our little cosmic calendar here very quickly as we start to wrap these things up. You can see there's a lot going on here. A lot of, again, this does not take into account of what they call the young universe. It actually does the opposite. It expands it out. There's lots of physical proof that this is what happened. But one of the things that happened, we got biologists here that can tell you about, is we had the explosion of called the Cambrian explosion, that third line, when all kinds of life appears with new DNA that contradicts some of our friends who say that this cannot happen without divine intervention. But as things go on, something weird happens. We start to have literal monsters on the earth. Instead of having an advance towards where things begin to look like God, we have things that look really bad and strange. They start eating things and they tear things up and they have huge teeth. So all of a sudden, they become extinct. We have this mass extinction event 66 million years ago. It's like God said, we're not going down this direction anymore. What I find interesting is some of you may remember there was a gentleman by the name of Dr. Herman Hay. He used to talk about how he felt personally, and again, this is not doctrine, that angels played a role in creation, and that this is where God saw some of these foul attitudes starting to appear as the creation took a turn for the worse. Instead of looking more like God, suddenly it looks like something else. So those all went away. So we're back now to verse 2. Since when the angelic rebellion took place, we're in the last half hour of that whole cosmic calendar. So we don't know for sure one way or the other, but it sure seems like that from that description, that's certainly possible. So we have some things that are faith-based, and it says in Hebrews 11, verse 3, by faith we understand where the universe came from, that it was created by this God of the universe. And so that contrasts directly with a lot of other ancient accounts, like the account of Gilgamesh and others, where gods are forced to partner with puny humans to somehow conquer and sustain the earth. In Genesis, it's exactly the opposite. It all happens deliberately. So, and again, this is where Paul, in his cosmological letter to the Colossians, confirms that. He says that Jesus Christ did all this. So I'm going to make three quick points and then wrap up. One of the things that's really amazing about Genesis is that when God recreates the universe, presuming that that's what happened, is that in verse 14, there's a very interesting word that he uses. He says, let the lights be for signs and for seasons. That word is mistranslated. That word refers to the holy days. He specifically says in Hebrew, and Alter and some of these other people point this out, that it's not an alliteration or just kind of a linguistic nicety. That's the same word you find used elsewhere in the Bible that talks about the holy days. So he's planting the holy days in the first chapter when he's recreating. And secondly, and the most important part of that, is that the Sabbath is literally baked into creation. The recreation that God himself is in charge of, there are no angels mentioned at all. At the end, he finishes creation or the recreation with the establishment of the Sabbath. That means the Sabbath is as much part of the physical world you live in as water, air, or anything else. So you can't do away with the Sabbath because it's part of creation. And the Bible is very explicit about that. So to wrap up here, the third point is that God, the second chapter of Genesis always talks about how when you talk to a biblical critic, they say, oh, this proves that the Bible isn't true because, look, it gives a completely different version of creation. Well, Alter, who's an expert on this, and not trying to prove any Christian point for sure, points out about how God is described in chapter 2. Instead of being this massive, powerful God, he gets down, he becomes a craftsman. He gets intimately, personally involved in the creation of man and woman. And a Hebrew reflects that. So we need to think about that when people say, well, you know, that documented hypothesis bit sure beats up on your God, doesn't it? No, not at all. Not at all. So finally, to wrap up, all power, what are we talking about here? Well, when we get to that part about what Paul was talking about, at the end of that verse, he talks about how that all power is provided to us that we might have the ability to achieve endurance and steadfastness. That word endurance, as I've said many times here before, is a power word, it's a biblical power word that is called, and I never pronounce it right, hypomme. Hypomme is that quality, it is produced only by trials. You have to go through a trial to get hypomme. And that's the same word translated steadfastness. It's Strong's G5281, as I've said very many, many times. It's the same word in James chapter 1, verse 2 that says, the testing of your faith produces hypomme, steadfastness. So when we see we have these trials, we have COVID, we have all this going on, that great power is specifically there to enable us to withstand. So, when you have your canoe moment, if you're in a COVID situation, and we've all been through trials in the last 2 years of all kinds. But when you're there, there's some things to take away from this God of the universe. There are three of them, and I'll just say them very quickly and end. We know we have some unbreakable promises that we can apply this all power to. God nor Christ will ever leave nor forsake us. We see that everywhere in the book of Joshua. It says, be strong and courageous. Secondly, Jesus tells us at the very end of Matthew 28, be sure of this, I'm with you to the end of the age. We have that all power with us at all times. And three, no matter what the trial, God gives us access to all power, to withstand and to become a conqueror. These trials, including the severe COVID trials that we're facing or may have faced, produce magnificent eternal character. It's the only place where we can get it. This character will last through all eternity. So, all power is available to us. It's ours to use. Let us claim this unbreakable promise of all power.